The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Our meditation group used to meet Sunday mornings in Portola Valley at the community center there many years ago. And we were there, I came up with an analogy. I want to share that analogy with you. It's an imperfect analogy, but it grew out of the situation we were in then. The community hall had a very big auditorium and had a linoleum floor that we would sit on Sunday mornings. And occasionally we'd come in Sunday morning after there'd been a party in the auditorium the night before. And they hadn't cleaned up. And so there would be a beer would be spilled on the floor. It'd be all sticky. They'd be walking across and there's sticky socks and there'd be a lot of dirt and dust and stuff. So the analogy is, imagine that, for 500 or 1,000 years, they didn't clean that floor. And so slowly, over the decades and centuries, the gunk builds up. And after a while, it's maybe 2 or 3 or 4 feet thick, all the dust and the beer, and it's got people just walking on it, so it gets really solid like cement. And after a few centuries, people have forgotten that there was this linoleum floor at the bottom. And then one day, someone went into the archives, and they found reference to a linoleum floor. The person would come out of the archive and say, oh, there's a linoleum floor down there. And everyone would say, no way. We know, it's just this floor there, it's 4 feet above the ground, and we have these steps we've kind of made that go up into it, and it's a solid marble-like stuff. There's no linoleum down there. So the person kind of is maybe a little bit foolhardy or insistent or really wants to know the truth really strongly or some reason is really motivated, gets hammer and chisel, gets jackhammer, and eventually out of long work, maybe years of hard work, gets through that marble-like hard steel gunk, beer and everything, vomit. And finally gets down and is able to clear out 1 square foot of the linoleum floor. There's a little shaft going down. And then the person, wow, it's true. The archives are right. There is a linoleum floor down here. And now, all I've managed to do is clear 1 square foot of it. Now I know in theory, if I have long enough, or we have enough work to do enough work, we could clear out all the gunk and have a complete linoleum floor again. So that's an analogy for the experience of awakening, of enlightenment. It can take a lot of work for some people. Sometimes it's very little, very easy for some people. Some people it takes a lot of effort. But it's the first experience of awakening is often like having that 1 square foot of the floor cleared. And from that person, now I know there's a floor. Now I know there's such a thing called awakening. And now I know what the work is. There's actually a lot more work to be done than getting that 1 square foot. There's like 300 square feet of panels. So it's 300 times as much work. Now some people just get content with their 1 square foot and think, well, that was good. And then they have this enlightened retirement. But the idea is to see the floor and then to see, oh, look, at least in theory, it's possible to clear more of it and do more work. And it's a lot more work to be done. And then the practice is based on that understanding, that knowledge that one has, it's self-experience that persons have, to then begin actualizing, fulfilling, or expanding out that awakening into more and more areas of one's life. Maybe the analogy doesn't work so well because it was not a very pretty linoleum floor we had there in Bertola Valley. But so it is. And a Buddha represents, you know, I don't know who the Buddha was. I never met him. And we have these books that tell us something about who he is. And we have a lot of idealization of the Buddha. That's what, you know, most Buddhists do. They idealize the Buddha. But was he partly a myth? Probably he was a real person, most likely. But how enlightened was he? Had he managed to clear out all the gunk? So the whole floor was clear? I would like to believe that. But, you know, I have no basis to really know for sure. But what the Buddha is for me, more than historical person, it represents the possibility, the capacity that we all have of clearing out all the floor, cleaning up the whole terrain. And it's a worthwhile endeavor, it's a worthwhile goal for anybody's life to do that work. And so having this image, this symbolic image of the possibility of doing it completely is inspiring, at least to me. I don't know whether I can do it in my lifetime, the whole thing. But that doesn't really matter so much to me as it does that I'm on the path to do that. That's the direction I'm working on. So, the gunk over linoleum floor maybe doesn't sound very inspiring. But there could be all kinds of other analogies, maybe. Another one maybe, which also maybe doesn't work too well, but maybe it's a little bit more inspiring, is that of a muddy pond. And so the pond is really muddy. And so they say, you know, if you leave the muddy pond alone, the mud will settle and you have a clear pond. So maybe that's true. And maybe this particular muddy pond will take a long time to clear that way. But maybe you can take a pipe, or you take a bucket out of the water out of the pond and let the mud in the bucket settle until you have clear water in the bucket. And then you know, oh, it's possible to have that clarity. And now it's a matter of, you know, doing it for the whole pond. So it's possible to have, in a very small way, very significant way, maybe very deep way, have an experience of awakening, of freedom, of peace, of putting down the burden, of seeing through the illusions that many of us can live in. It's possible to see it very clearly, very genuinely. And then that clarity and that freedom and that peace then becomes a reference point for how a person wants to live the rest of their life. So in Buddhism, we say that there's a big difference that the practice a person does, of mindfulness, of concentration, of compassion, of loving kindness, letting go, the practices that the Buddhists do are considered to be the same before awakening and after awakening. So it looks the same. So it's not like, well, I got my first experience of the linoleum and now I can, you know, do something different. You get to do exactly the same. But the difference is that you have a reference point where you know for yourself, oh, this is true. You know it. It's like in your bones then. It's in your marrow. It's like you really know, oh, this level of peace, of freedom, of awakening, is really, you know, it's been experienced. It's like if you never knew how to swim, you lived in the desert far from any kind of water, and someone said, oh, human beings can float and swim in water. No. People can't do that. I can't even imagine there's so much water. And then finally the person goes to the ocean and someone teaches the person to swim. And wow, now I know I can swim. And you really know it. So in Buddhism, they say there's a point where some experience, some deep experience or some significant experience becomes a reference point for how one guides one's life, orients one's life, directs one's life. And when awakening is that guide, the awakening shows us what's possible in a way that we can't even imagine sometimes without that awakening. So, for example, it's possible to be tense and not know it. Or it's possible, you know, it's possible to be tense and to know it. But many people, most people, carry levels of tension in their body, in their minds, that is taken to be just ordinary. Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? And then they have some kind of, do something, it could be a variety of things, that allows that tension to settle. Maybe they have a long vacation, maybe they go on a long retreat, maybe, you know, whatever. And then, I had no idea that I was carrying so much tension. Or I had no idea that I was carrying so much preoccupation. So one of the waking ups that meditators do, some of them, some of you, is sit down to try to be still with your mind, and the mind doesn't cooperate. And the mind sometimes can be out of control. And has a mind of its own, is wandering this way and that. And people new to meditation will say, wow, I had no idea that my mind was so active and so busy and so caught up in so many different things. Before seeing that, before having some kind of reference point to see that, that's ordinary. So as people, then if you get some deep relaxation or some deep stillness in the mind, you have a different reference point from which to understand your life, our life. And then the busy, agitated mind is no longer seen as being a natural thing. This is the way things are going to always have to be. The tensions we carry in our body are seen, well, it doesn't have to be this way. There's other ways as well. And then it becomes interesting to ask, is this significant enough to warrant a new way of living a life? Is this significant enough that it becomes motivating to practice a discipline, a spiritual discipline? Is it motivating enough to try to do something to have this different quality of life that's possible? So what does it take for it to be motivating? For some people, it's just so obvious because the alternative involves so much suffering. That life as it usually lived is so much suffering, so uncomfortable, that it just does not tenable to continue this way. So there has to be some practice, some way of addressing it. For other people, they see the effect life as normal has on other people. You know, I'm always so greedy, I'm always so angry, and I'm lashing out at people all the time. I'm not very kind to people. And so, not so much for their own sake, but in order to be a better influence, better citizen, better helpful for other people. People that are motivated try to do this inner work to clear out the gunk, to clear out the floor, to open up, to clear out the pond, to create the clarity. Some people are motivated because the linoleum floor they saw, that 1 square foot, is so beautiful. It's the most beautiful thing they've ever seen. It wouldn't have been the one in Portola Valley, but that beauty is it's just so, you know, it's like some people are oriented towards the light, moving towards the light, and some people are oriented away from the darkness. So both are fine, just different. I don't know why people are different. Some people see the floor, and that's enough for them. Some people see the gunk, and that's enough for them to motivate them. So, another thing about this awakening is it kind of points to two highlights, two areas of our life. And one is, in Buddhist terms, they would say one is has to do with our affect, our emotional life or our motivational life. And the other has to do with our cognitive life, our ideas, what we live by. And awakening affects both, but in different ways. And it's also at different times. So, in terms of our affect, clinging. The experience of awakening is an experience of the release from clinging. Some very profound release of being held, holding tight to something, clinging to something, grasping. Or the opposite, or in Buddhism is considered the same variety of this, of pushing things, resisting. And so with awakening, there's this letting go. But in that letting go, there's also sometimes a clear understanding of what it is we're letting go of. So the ideas we have, what we're holding on to. So there's letting go, and then there's the ideas. We change our understanding of what it is we're holding on to. So this last few days, I went with my son, my 6-year-old son, to a science museum. And they had this wonderful exhibit. It was a big box, about 3 feet by 3 feet, cube box. And it had a little hole in the front that was maybe 4-inch square hole. Certainly big enough to put your hand into the box through the hole. And then you could see an image through the box, a three-dimensional image. And this particular image was a spring, a coil, that was maybe about, I don't know, 3 inches tall. And it was just kind of sitting there, hovering there inside the box. And the instructions was to put your hand in it and grab it. And so you'd put your hand in the box to grab it. It was really close. It was obvious where it was. And, you know, my hand coordination is, you know, was quite good. And, you know, I put my hand in there and just nothing there. I put my hand up and look again. And sure enough, the coil is there. Put my hand in, looked again. And, so what it was, there was a real coil, but it wasn't where it appeared to be. It was just below the lip of that opening, so you couldn't see it, just below. And the opposite wall of the box was a large concave mirror. And so somehow, with how light reflects off a concave mirror, it reflected back. It picked up the image. Mirror picked up the image of the coil and reflected it back slightly above where it actually was. But because of the mirror was curved, somehow it gave the appearance that the coil was kind of hovering there in midair. So you can go and try to grab it, right? It's a three-dimensional thing. Quite something. So how many of our ideas, how many of the things that we grab onto are like that? You know, it's one thing to grab onto a bell, something physical, some physical phenomena, you know. But most people don't suffer because of what they grab on physically. Even if I'm attached to this bell, it's not the bell that I'm attached to. It's probably the ideas of what the bell means and the significance of the bell for me. So in many spiritual circles, they talk about awakening as being clearing away the veils of illusion. So we no longer, we kind of see things more clearly. We're no longer mystified or no longer enchanted by things that hold us in their spell. So for a while, that coil held me in its spell. I was going to get it. I tried many times. What's going on here? Until I read the description. So one of the illusions that we cling to has a lot to do with who we think we are as a subject, who we are as a person. And so it can take very simple forms, like I used to have the illusion that it was really important that people like me. And I had to be a likable person. And I would do the social gymnastics to try to get people to like me. It was really exhausting. And probably didn't work very well either. And I was operating under illusion that I had to be a certain kind of person. And I had to maintain a certain kind of beingness in order to be successful or be something. And that was just an illusion. It was very motivating. It's a lot of strong emotions around it, a lot of strong feelings about it. And in fact, sometimes there were people who participated with me in that illusion. And because people were participating in it, it felt, it must be real. It was a period in my life where it was hard to let go of some of my self-attachment and self-image that I had, other people expected me to maintain that image, to be that way. And as I was trying to let go of it, they kind of didn't want me to, they didn't allow me to. And that was kind of hard to kind of change when people wanted me to be the old way. So sometimes there's a seeing through, oh, just ideas, all these ideas, swimming in ideas, social ideas, familial ideas, all these ideas about who we're supposed to be, what I'm supposed to get, who we are in relationship to each other, all these ideas. And those ideas are ideas that have no more reality than that coil, the image of the coil, the reflection of the coil. It isn't that they are not inconsequential. They are consequential because people live their lives by it and make decisions by it. But to wake up to its illusionary nature, dreamlike nature, is part of what it is to wake up, to be awake, to clear out the linoleum floor. And so that's one part, is the cognitive part. But the affect, how we've been affected, is also important, because if I cling, if I spend the whole day in the museum trying to cling, kind of grasp that coil over and over, hour after hour after hour, and even if at the end of the day I finally realize it's not graspable, it's just an illusion, it's just a reflection there, and I leave, cognitively I've woken up, but my poor hand's exhausted. And not only is it exhausted, but I might have actually built up a habit in my hand of grasping and leaving the museum kind of. And so the after effect of all that grasping lingers. And it lingers in terms of the tension, the exhaustion that was there, perhaps. It also lingers in terms of maybe something has to, the kinks have to be worked out. You know, maybe I've kind of really gotten tight and stiff from all that grasping, trying to grasp. So I had to spend the next week, you know, kind of massaging my fingers and hands and really kind of working out the kinks. And also my hands are not very strong, so I've really used those muscles a lot, so they're really tired. And I can't really hardly use it for a while the next few days. And there's a variety of... the habit is there, so, I already said that, but just keep grasping. So the various effects of having grasped for all that time, I have to still live with, even though I've seen that what I was grasping at was an illusion. Does that make sense? So this is a very important distinction, very important point. So in Buddhist terminology, sometimes they'll say that when you have some degree of awakening, you still have to bear your karma. There's still a momentum. You set in motion all this momentum in your life, and that momentum has to kind of still, you still have to work it out. So play it out, let it work itself out, and resolve it, deal with it, do something with it. So it's one thing to finally let go of the coil, the illusion, and really see, oh, it's possible not to grasp. I didn't realize it was possible not to grasp at it until I saw it wasn't even there. Wow, this is really significant. And now the work is to learn that I can trust keeping my hand open. And that might take a lot longer to really trust that. There might be a lot of reasons why I feel like I have to keep grasping at things. So before and after awakening, the practice, as far as I know, is the same. And so it doesn't really matter too much if you have some experience of awakening or not. What matters, from a Buddhist point of view, what matters is you just keep doing the practice. You are where you are in your practice, and you do what you do. Keep practicing, showing up, look carefully, learn to let go in a wise way. And And then what happens, happens. What needs to happen will happen. And it's, I think, one of the really beautiful things to do with the human life, profound and noble things, to clarify these matters of the heart and the mind, clarify in all the ways, in the cognitive ways, in terms of understanding, but clarify also in terms of all the stuff and momentum and habits that there, clear it all out, so that the heart is pure and beautiful, and the heart is your heart becomes a heart that's safe to hold other people in it. So that your heart is a safe place, so that your heart can become as big as the world, and the whole world can be held in your heart, and the whole world will feel safe in that heart of yours. Isn't that a great thing? I think it is. So, we have 15 minutes, and now I welcome you to ask any questions or make comments or protest. So, yes, please.
I had just a, your story of linoleum floor reminded me of an article I read. I can't remember. I think probably Smithsonian. I can't remember what town it was. It had sort of like an turkey-like image, but one of these areas of the world where they've been living in the exact same town for hundreds of years. And they got it into their mind that they were going to clear down the surface of the road in these little tiny narrow lanes. And they went down like 4 or 5 feet. So it actually does happen. But the karma effect of this, what you were talking about, is over the centuries the people in the houses had moved their doors up. And so now they had to then build steps to go down to the road. Which I thought was awesome.
Yeah, so all of us are doing much more work than we need to. We all also have these steps that have to go up and down, up and down. And if you're awake, you just be on level ground. So, someone else?
You said that your personal experience was that you realized that you weren't, weren't being, I guess, authentic so in your social situations. I was just wondering how you came to that realization.
Oh, in many ways. it's something I had to rediscover or discover in different ways repeatedly. Sometimes I saw myself playing social games where I tried to present myself in a certain way that I wasn't really in order to make an impression on people. So that wasn't very authentic. Sometimes I was trying to fulfill other people's ideals of who I should be, rather than some inner understanding of what I should be, like my parents or, you know, sometimes my Buddhist teachers even. And I thought, oh, I was supposed to be a good Buddhist. And sometimes my lack of authenticity had to do with hiding. I didn't want people to know who I was. I was afraid or felt like I should be, you know, I should, and so I kind of did a variety of things to kind of, not exactly lie, but you know, not be exposed, not be revealed. And it was great when I was relatively new to all this. I would go visit the San Francisco Zen Center and sometimes hang out with some of the more experienced longtime practitioners there. And the experience I loved because it was the first time I met a group of people who, when I kind of would do my social games, they wouldn't respond. And I felt like it was this mirror, and I got to see myself, I see what I was doing with such clarity. It was painful, but I thought, oh, this is really important, this is really, I'm blessed to have this opportunity. So it was one of the decisions, one of the reasons I decided to go live at Zen Center was because I wanted to be around people who wouldn't allow me to get away with these things the way my friends would. And then after about a couple of years of there, a year there, I remember, maybe more than that. It happened a few different times. But I remember there was a time when I could see that what was needed was for me to let go of a certain self-image, self-representation, self-concept that I had, what I was trying to prove myself to be. And that I was really afraid to do that. And I could feel the fear. And I know what I have to do, but I'm not going to do it. And so it took a while sometimes to go through it. And one of the last times I remember going through that kind of cycle was I knew I had to let go of something. So it was, I think it was the second time that I went to practice in Asia. I was saying, I need a ritual to help me get over that hump. And so I said, okay, crossing the international date line in the Pacific, that'll be my ritual. You know, a new life, let it all go behind me. So I don't know if that answered your question well enough, but that's what came out of me. You want to ask again? Or if you want to say to me why it's an important question for you.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I'm just beginning in my practice and, you know, so I'm just, you know, trying to realize, I guess, other ways in which I'm not, you know, authentic or, and so it just sort of struck a bell for me. I mean, in that sense.
Mm-hmm. One of the great, there's many ways of learning about these things, but one of the great ways I think is, makes it safer and more comfortable maybe, is if a lot of this stuff can be revealed as in meditation as we get more and more relaxed. And to be relaxed and settled and feel more peaceful, that because often to be unauthentic means we're not peaceful. Somehow the mind is active and involved. And so as the mind gets more and more relaxed, then it's, you feel, oh, you know, it's actually letting go of that actually will provide me with something better, something nicer. So it'd be good to let go.
Thank you.
And also it's easier to see it. The more still the mind is, the easier to see the variety of, you know, complications, complicated ways the mind operates.
I'm wondering whether, you know, any analogy has its limits. And I was wondering if the analogy is so true where in the real life in Portola Valley, you even quantified it. You said 1 square foot. Yes, indeed. So you do a lot of work. You get 2, 3, 4, and eventually you're finished and you always know about where you are. But I don't think this is true with regard to awakening. Do you ever enlightenment? Do you ever know how far you are down the path or the path just keeps going and going and going? There's no measurements allowed.
Well, I don't know. I'm not qualified to answer that question, but I can answer it in the way I talked about it earlier, that for me, the Buddha represents the possibility of clearing it out the whole way and finishing the whole job. And whether there is such a person who ever did that, I'd like to believe that's the case. I don't know. I have some sense of a direction and a possibility. So that's how I measure it. Does that answer your question?
You measure it for yourself how?
No, I don't bother measuring it.
That's where the analogy ends.
Measuring
it. One is measurable, one is not.
Okay. Measuring is just another illusion. You know, one of the really fun things about all this is that, you know, you grasp, and you realize at some point that what you're grasping is an illusion. And then you realize that the hand that's grasping is an illusion. And then you realize that the one who's trying to do the grasping is an illusion. So the floor is an illusion, the gunk, you know, so, you know, measuring it. Yes, please.
Yeah, a couple of things. I have kind of a funny take on the illusion thing. Probably most people here are familiar with city powers, levitation, mind reading, walking in water, and all that good stuff. I think we're under an illusion that we can't do those things. I kind of sense that I feel that enlightenment is a normal state of being. Anybody who isn't enlightened is crazy. The evidence of that is just the way the planet is now. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas of how to break through the illusion that we can't do these things. Because I've always thought that levitating and things like that should be a normal thing you could do. You just get in touch with that pervading pervasive consciousness, and you should be able to do those things.
Why bother? Why bother? It's usually easier to take the airplane.
Oh, the hassle in airports now.
It is a hassle.
I'd rather learn how to teleport. Just stand up in Bangkok.
The only people I know who kind of, the only people I know about who say they levitate is the TM people, and they seem mostly like more like trampoline life. They've gone bouncing a little bit, you know. I don't know what that was about, but, you know, flying, an airplane to get them a lot farther.
I didn't want to focus on levitation necessarily,
And now that we have Bluetooth, so I don't think we need to mind read anymore. I'm not so interested in that, so I don't really have an answer for you. To me, it's enough to be free of suffering and to have the compassion that comes from that. And the rest is just Disneyland kind of stuff. And I don't even know if it's possible. But if when you've learned to fly, please come and show us.
Well, the other thing, real quick, is I really relate to what you say about trying to blend in and presenting a certain image and so forth. And that makes a lot of sense. And
I've tried to do that over the years myself, but then I find myself caught in the hole, being a people pleaser and that sort of thing. And I also recognize that there's the other extreme. I had a friend years ago, and he one of his personality traits is he was a braggart. And it would really turn people off. And I tried to suggest to him he kind of tone things down a little bit. He couldn't see that. So I think in some ways we do have to, if we have certain traits we're aware of that aren't particularly ingratiating, maybe we need to tone some of them down, even though it is kind of manipulative. Would you go along with that?
Oh, yeah. I think we want to be, I think we want to, not cause harm. And so sometimes we need to adjust who we are for the situation we're in. We do that all the time naturally. I mean, you go to a funeral and usually you don't start talking about how terrible the Giants pitchers are doing this season. You know, you kind of, you know, in a loud voice. Usually you don't do that at a funeral. that's not the right time. You tone that part down. You go to a kindergarten or nursery preschool class and you don't start talking about, sex and drugs. You know to tone that down there. So it's a normal thing to adjust how we are, how we present ourselves. And I think it's actually very healthy to have some, to be able to monitor oneself, know what one's effect is on other people, and to adjust how we are to make a healthy effect, But to do that, it's possible to do that with some authenticity, it's possible to do it without it. We're not supposed to just go through life without any concern for other people and without any kind of real self-monitoring and self-adjusting according to the situation. Sounds like your friend is probably not so socially aware. One more. Yes. If you can wait for the mic, please, I'd appreciate it.
So, I think you already talked about it, but I always forget, and I wonder if you could talk about it one more time, which is I get stuck in thinking that if I meditate enough, I'll somehow have an outcome, which may be clearing the mud, and then I get lost and expect there to be an outcome, and then there never is one.
Yes,
I realize that then the idea would be to let it go or let it be. And so then there seems to be this. Yeah, so I get stuck there.
So if I understand what you're saying, it sounds like you have kind of magical thinking that if you just sit enough, do your duty and sit enough on the cushion, meditate enough, so the universe will take care of you in some way and provide you with enlightenment. And the response to that was one teacher had was if sitting was where it's at, chickens would be enlightened. So more is needed than just to sit. there has to be some inner engagement in the process of sitting, and what form of inner engagement that is appropriate for the task at hand. And part of the task, part of the job of a meditator is to learn what that inner activity is that is required of us in order to have sitting be productive and helpful. And there's many answers to that, or many aspects to that, but to give you just one little thing that you can leave with today, is to learn how to relax deeply in the mind and heart, and how to let go. If you can follow those two guideposts, you'll go really far. There's more to be done, but those two will take you a long way. Okay, so thank you, and I hope that you have a beautiful linoleum floor where you live. Yeah, I know.